Bing, bang, boom. KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. It's Monday, January 3rd, 2011. It's the What Now Show, Mondays 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The website, www.pantedmonkey.org. Most of the interviews we do are archived there. And we're very, very happy to have in the studio Pat Hunt. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
And Susie Gruber joins us also in the studio. Susie.
Hi there.
How you doing? How you doing? Well, the holidays are over, and it's time to once again turn our attention to the real world.
Yeah, cut the small talk. Let's go right to it.
Yeah, let's go right to it.
By the way, thanks for bringing me in on a wave of bop. I love that.
Bringing you in on what?
A wave of bop.
A wave of bop. My pleasure. That was, what do we have here? That was a Fats Navarro memorial album from the mid late 40s with Bud Powell and Kenny Clarke, Tad Dameron, Kenny Dorham. These are big time jazz people.
Actually,
Pat,
I've been looking for that album, actually.
Well, here it is.
Terrific.
You take it home with you. Do you like jazz?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
That's good.
Yeah, it makes us move.
This was the beginning of my social alienation because I was a great jazz aficionado in my early teens. And that's when the rock thing started to happen. And I became disgusted with my culture and its vulgarity and its cheapness as I went sailing off into basically irrelevance.
Pat's irrelevance. So we could talk for hours.
It's become a theme. It's not as dramatic as your previous guests, but or cataclysmic. It's just been sort of incremental from very early age. Yeah,
yeah. I want to hear more about this, but first I want to hear a little bit about your background.
Checkered. Is that enough?
Yes, that's plenty.
Okay.
I've known Pat for several years. He's been a good friend. He's been very helpful for the radio show here. He's been nothing but supportive and hands-on helpful. So, and Pat, is it fair to call you a vagabond? No, I don't like that
word.
Is
fine.
Is that okay?
Nomad, whatever.
Nomad.
Homeless? How do you want to say it?
Well, I think you've essentially been living out of your car for a few years, haven't you?
About 3 years now, yeah. In fact, exactly 3 years, pretty much.
But rather than an old jalopy strewn with Burger King wrappers... Your car is strewn with photographic equipment.
Gadgets. I've got a car full of gadgets. Yeah.
And these gadgets, what are they for?
Well, they do all sorts of things, but primarily, the thrust has been to do photography, primarily wildlife. I just came to a place in my life where I was disentangled from social relationships and jobs and stuff. I'm retired. I'm old. And I just said, what do I want to do? I was forced to ask myself, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to buy a little car that gets good mileage. I got a little Golf diesel, gets 40 miles a gallon. I took the back seat out of it so I could put in all my gear, and I bought a new camera. I got a Nikon 300D, which is a basic prosumer camera, and all the toys, and went off into the woods. And I've been wandering through various kinds of woods, beautiful places, national parks. Started in Baja, went all the way up into British Columbia, made the shuttle a few times over the years, back up there into Alaska, through grizzly bears, through coyotes, through bobcats, bison, fabulous creatures that live, cohabit this planet with us. And have been more and more refining my work towards birds, and spent a lot of time as a result in Florida recently, where there are a lot of lovely birds, and they allow photographers to get close to them in certain places. And I spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah. Your photography passion, does this have roots from earlier in your life, or did you just take this up recently?
That's a kind of a trick question, because I've always had a visual aesthetic, and but I was never a good photographer. I'm too cheap to use film. I'm too shaky to use the usual techniques of photography. But I've developed some techniques since digital that have allowed me to kind of express myself in a different way. And my stuff is visible at pathunt.net. There's a link there to my Flickr photos, and you can get an idea of what we're talking about. I'm holding the picture up now in front of the microphone, but I don't know how well you can see it from here, because we're clear out in Occidental.
Yeah, it's a little bit out of focus.
Is it? Yeah. Okay, so pathunt.net. Say it over and over.
Excellent.
Not pathunt.com.
Excellent.
No, that'll get you a real estate thing or something. pathunt.net.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Pat, there are two audiences that I think would benefit from your experience as a serious photographer. One is the folks who are not photographers, and I want to ask you a question or two on their behalf. I'd like you to please share with us what the particular aesthetic of photography is, if that's a fair question, and what it gives us or what it shows us that other media don't.
I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that, but I can talk a little bit about it. I can say, first of all, that I come to photography as part of my sensitivity to what I've watched through my lifetime is the degradation of wild nature. And this has been at various times heartbreak to the point of despair. And I have been pretty depressed. So it also has functioned for me as a therapy, because what I found was, instead of going around shaking my head and criticizing and judging and saying, well, these people are messing up the planet over here and these people are messing it up over there, now I go around and I look for frames of beauty. And then I put them on the web. So those people that you're talking about who don't do photography can come and see the beauty of these animals and this wonderful, wonderful legacy that we are heir to and that we are rapidly diminishing.
I don't know if you've studied film as a medium formally. My sense is perhaps not. I don't know.
A little.
But there's photography is not anything other than itself. Photography is a particular medium of communication, of presentation, that has its own virtues or its own distinguishing elements. I'm fishing here.
Okay, well, let me say this then. As a practitioner of meditation, I've become less and less enthralled with words as a way to communicate, even though here we are on the radio, and you and I both gifted people with words. We are verbally somewhere at the end of the scale. But that doesn't matter, because it's not doing the job. How do you impact the situation that we're in? It's got to come into your gut somehow. It's got to be in the feelings. It can't be an abstract set of scratch marks on paper that you interpret symbolically. They may evoke that and they may not. A good writer can do that. But I just chose to go a little more direct. And as music, as we started the show, that kind of thing. What is that? What a mystery. What a remarkable, wonderful mystery. How is it that we resonate with that? What is it that is in those sounds, in the physics of music, that sends us into an emotional state? There's something going on here, and we're not investigating it as deeply as we might, because we're distracted, as your previous guest pointed out so eloquently.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk to us a little bit about the technical aspects of your mastery or your your developing mastery of the form. There are many in our audience who are photographers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so I do a lot of just ordinary photography, particularly bird stuff. I like to do the birds in flight. So there are certain parameters involved in that. But what I am most famous for, insofar as I am famous, and it's fun to watch that graph on Flickr. It gives you a description of fame. I think I got a little more than 15 minutes. I got about 16 and a half minutes because of a blog article that a brilliant blogger, David Hobby, wrote. His blog is called The Strobist, which is a wonderful course in using lights to do photography, portable strobe lights to do pretty exotic photography. And I took what he gave me and ran with it and dovetailed it into high-speed photography techniques. So I use strobes to make a much shorter exposure than any camera that I know of can do. My camera is pretty fast. It'll do an 1/8000th of a second. But the bird photographs I'm doing, like a totally stopped hummingbird, requires a much shorter exposure time. So my exposure times are down to a 25,000th of a second. And so I use a lot of lights because they're on for so little time. In order to expose the sensor, I have to have four of them, and I put them pretty close to the birds, within 6 or 8 inches. And the birds are fine with that. They flinch at first a couple times, and then they come in, and I often give them a lot of space in between so that I don't have to feel like I'm abusing the little creatures, even though they're much more ferocious than I am in their behavior patterns. But, I don't know. That sort of exposes it, so to speak.
Yeah. Is it like setting up a blind?
I don't have to use a blind for the hummingbirds because they don't really care. I mean, we must look like, shall I say, cows to them. Something slow and large and
perhaps stupid.
I don't know if they make that judgment, but by their lights, probably, yeah. So they don't really worry too much about us because they can tell that we're just not equipped to operate at their rate, so they can be out of our way before we could do anything. So
right. They can relax around us.
Yeah,
we don't
much,
have a chance.
Pretty much, yeah. Right. They're useless. Yeah.
Right. So 16 and a half minutes was demonstrated by a response to this blog.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it went up to, I think I had 24,000 hits on my site that day that it first came out. And then I got to watch that graph kind of bounce around, always in a downward direction until, nothing, say nothing, or 24 or 100 or a couple hundred, depending on how many cards I've given to people so they'll go look at my site, or how many times I've been on the radio saying pathunt.net. So I get to get a graphic of fame, and it's like all those other little things that we get trapped into. It's very compelling and stupid waste of time.
Yeah. But it's not a waste of time being out there shooting away.
I love being with the animals. I love being in wilderness, watching the brilliance of these creatures, what evolution has granted them in their behavior patterns, and that we seldom know about, and that they seldom show us unless you've spent a lot of time with them. You'll find these birds, and you'll look in the bird book, and it'll give a couple of calls for a bird, or you'll go on the web, and you'll listen to a couple of calls, and there'll be maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 different calls. But when you get to know the animals, you'll find that they've got an incredible repertoire, as articulate and busy and varied as ours.
Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to try any field recordings?
I have often been, yeah. In fact, I tried to get some gear recently, but it didn't work out. I've got a little bit of a digital recorder, and sometimes I do. I think there might be a couple of them that I have soundtracks on my Flickr site. If you look up the Pacific Tree Frog, I think you'll be edified by both the picture, which was done with this technique, the high-speed photography technique, and the soundtrack that's there too, so you can hear the ribbit of their mating call.
Has all this communion soothed your anguished heart?
Yeah, very much. I find nature is almost always soothing, and not just to me. It's lots of people find it that way. I've talked to a lot of people about where they get their spiritual hit, and I would say 70-80% of people come back immediately with nature, whether they go to the beach and watch the sea for a while or go to the woods or something. But most people do feel a rapport and a calm from being with nature.
You mentioned to me earlier that you have the wonderful opportunity to get out on the water soon.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Yeah.
Why don't you let us?
Well, tomorrow I'm flying back to Florida, where I've been off and on quite a bit for the last year, and I have a dear friend there I've known for 40 some years since we were involved in a rock band in the 60s, if one of my checkers. He has a lovely sailboat there, and he wants to go to the Bahamas, and he wants a crew, and I'm the guy.
Yeah. So will we be able to be perched on your shoulder?
Sure, insofar as I have, and when I have internet access, I hope to be as far from that stuff a lot of the time, but when I do check in, I will upload in various internet cafes that we can find in those parts, and then you can track whatever beauty I'm capturing out there.
Nice. I can use a trip to the Bahamas,
yeah,
even vicariously.
All right.
So
you got it. You're on.
So, Pat, I want to ask you a kind of a deeper question about your relationship with your subject. You have expressed really clearly such a deep love of nature, and I'm curious in that how you came to choose animals as your primary animals and birds as your primary subjects when there's such a wide variety of possibility there.
Well, there's certainly a wide variety of possibility, and there's a certain, I think, typical evolution of photographers where they work their way from scenery, from landscapes, through various nature shots, and eventually they usually end up with doing people portraits. I don't like people that much. I've spent most of my life complaining about them and feeling victimized by my culture and the, well, how did Lao Tzu say it? The wandered off into the desert, sick at heart at the ways of men.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you talked a little bit about your work with hummingbirds. I'm curious how you connect with your subjects when you're photographing them. Do you
food.
So you go out and you tempt them with...
They're like us. They respond to gifts of resources, and we have refined our resources into this thing called money, which is the kind of crack of resources, and it makes us crazy, as we've heard endlessly discussed and from your previous conversation with Mr. Goldstein. That's sort of the root of this thing, and the animals are corrupted by it too. I had my favorite fox pictures that I got in BC as a result of tourists who were feeding this fox. So he was willing to come close to my car and to me, and it doesn't serve him or his kind to have that happen. It allowed me to get very evocative photographs, a close-up, full face, full frame of this lovely animal. But there's a sadness to it, too. Our corruption of the grizzly bears in Canada and Alaska is killing them right and left because they become corrupted and start browsing, grazing the trash of these towns that don't have protected trash receptacles because they're expensive, and so then these animals get killed. The hummingbirds respond to nectar. They come in, and they're very accommodating. They're great photographic subjects because they have a grooved tongue. It's designed for capillary action, so they can stick this thing out as long as their beak is. They can stick their tongue that far beyond it, and they have a special, like a wishbone-shaped bone at the root of their tongue that allows them to leverage this thing right out down there. And then it just, because of capillary action, brings the nectar right up into the tongue. So with my little cup, they don't even have to do that. They just fill the tongue up, and then they back off about 4 to 6 inches to download their tongue to swallow the nectar. And they look around, and it's perfect photo op. Snip, snap, click, click, and they're immortal.
Wow. Wow. So I hear in your description of this fascination with experimenting with how to capture these images. Can you talk a little bit about your journey with...
Yeah, I'm a sucker for a challenge. I'm compulsive as can be, and I was house sitting for this friend of mine. She's been feeding these birds at this house for, I guess, around 15 years probably. So there were, it was like living in an aviary. I mean, the place, there were hundreds and hundreds of birds in these trees all the time, and hummingbirds and coming in, and compulsive photographer, birds, well, you know, challenge, how do you photograph a hummingbird? So I went on the web and started studying high-speed photography techniques, and I had one flash that was given to me when I was given a camera. What was that birthday party? You came to that birthday party. It was 69, I think. Probably 69 years old. And I got that camera, remember? I got that camera.
Yes.
And they gave me a flash, too, a strobe. And that was nice, but I was reading the strobist blog, and it seemed like I needed a little better flash, a little more involved flash. So I got a second flash. And that was enough for me to get the first photograph of a hummingbird where I could see... Oh my God, this little juvenile Anna's that had like little, you could see individual feathers on the breast, and it was, they were like rubies, and there were these little gold individual feathers you could see on the head. And most of the bird was out of focus because I didn't have as much gear as I do now, but I immediately went out and bought two more strobes with my credit card that I couldn't afford, but I had to have it so that I could do the real deal.
Neat, neat.
Yeah.
So how much research do you end up doing on the various animals and birds that you photograph? Do you go and read at all about their habitats and habits, or simply observation?
Well, I love to do both. I'm a retired librarian, so I have an honorary librarian's neurosis, and I will... hunt things to the ends of the earth if the question comes up. I don't like it to linger unresolved. So, for example, recently I know where there's a wonderful, huge 12-foot-wide nest for a bald eagle nest in Florida that I've gotten some nice shots from before when they had a couple of fledglings in the nest. And I went back this fall, but I wasn't really sure about what the sequence is in their nesting habits in that area. So I went on the web and I studied and found out that the time I was there, they were mostly just building the nest. And then the next month, which probably would be December, they were going to lay the eggs. And in January, they're raising the chick, you know. So there was this whole process. In the process of doing that, I found something very interesting. I found the laws in Florida for construction in the neighborhood of eagle's nest, and they're really stringent. I mean, they have a monitor come in at least once a week, maybe more, watching these birds, making sure that the construction is not bothering them, and they can shut down these construction sites if they feel that they're encroaching on birds. And I thought, hey, we're finally doing it. We're making the turn. It's a big ship, and it's taking a long time to turn around, but we are creating laws to protect our cohabitors of this planet. And, you know, I've heard so many people talk about that. Where are the rights? Where are the rights of these other creatures that we're just trampling over? And in large part, we're not giving them much of a break. There's some small examples, and they do tend to focus on what are called the charismatic megafauna, the animals that will cause people to feel concern for them. It does not include the bacteria in your stomach ordinarily yet, but we may get there later. In the meantime, the antelope that are trying to migrate from Wyoming to Montana are blocked by housing development. We don't really hear much about that. And meantime, the habitat encroachment is just overwhelmingly the story of my last 3 years. Even though I was looking for the beauty, what I always heard in the background was this other element. For example, I'm standing on the platform of the Bear Observation Area in Hyder, Alaska, overlooking the salmon stream. And it was late in the day. I spent the whole day there, many days, many weeks. Tourists would come in on the bus and they'd say, when's the next bear? When do I get to see a bear? And I say, well, if you do what I do and you spend 8 or more hours a day here, you will see some bears. And it was at the end of the day, and it was starting to get a little bit dark, and we saw this enormous grizzly bear down the stream. And the ranger said, well, let's be quiet, because a bear this big, you don't usually see around people. And I asked him later, what did that mean? Does that mean that the big bears that come around people get killed? And he said, yeah. Hmm. That's what happens. They get shot.
Wow.
So, that's the story, the backstory of all the beauty that I've been trying to gather, and that there's a sad, a tragic story really going on in the background, and I don't know when people will respond to this. They are responding to it, as I say, by the eagle laws, but it's a crisis, as we know.
Yeah.
That's why the show is here.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And the more we articulate our developing understanding, the better, because it's about perceiving reality in such an accurate fashion that that nature's grace and elaboration is naturally fulfilled, which is just a fancy way of saying that as our consciousness develops in a healthy fashion, we can begin to very willingly, willfully change our behaviors. When we understand, the more we understand that there are just great improvements in our human understanding that are essentially in our midst now, just waiting to be bled into the mainstream understanding, or to be what am I saying here? I'm saying that we're on the edge of a genuine human maturation.
And to continue that thought, that we're on the edge of really being willing to take responsibility for our impact on our Earth, on planet Earth, and all of the beings that live here with us.
Because we're obliged to, not because we're necessarily so wonderful, although we actually are, if we hopefully someday we'll get around to owning that. But in the meantime, we're being forced to bring forth the deeper salvatory elements of our humanity, which are in there.
Well, I love that you understand that and that you had that vision. And I'd say a couple words about my process in that too, because I got this when I was quite young, and I'm way old now. I got this probably before I was 20, 1959, I think it was, I was hitchhiking to Florida from Michigan, and I was passing Detroit, and I looked at this world as a wreck, and I saw that we had done irreversible changes to the planet. And as I studied this situation through the years, I became convinced that nobody was noticing. I was the only guy. I mean, once in a while, you might hear a voice in the wilderness. I'm talking, you know, back then, 1960s, early 60s, before it was popular. And there was nobody talking about the ecology. The word was just being invented by Mr. Bateson. Mr. Gregory Bateson, who I highly recommend his works, brilliant works, Steps to an Ecology of the Mind, and Mind in Nature and Necessary Unity, seminal stuff. And over the years, I went into huge despair, black despair about the future of this planet. There were phases where I thought, well, since I'm the only guy, I'm the guy who has to do something about it. I have to make unilateral terrorist actions to wake these people up to where they're heading. But the fact is, here it is, you know, a new year, 2011, and I would say more than half of the people in this country, at least, if you ask them, is there a problem, they'll say yes. Whereas when I started, they didn't. And so I have to say, there is a process, there is progress. You're right, Ken. We are evolving. We are moving in that direction. Of course, there's still a lot of question about how much turbulence we're going to require in order to how firmly our backs have to be pressed to the wall before we move. But we are moving.
It's getting pretty firm.
Yeah. Well, it seems that way to you, and it does to me. But I don't think because of the deceptive character of our culture and its manipulation by short-termers, it's hard to get that through to everybody. It's hard to get consensus.
Well, yeah. I have another question for you. We talked a little bit about in the beginning of the show that you've chosen to live a vagabond lifestyle in your car, and I'm curious how that decision to unplug from a more mainstream lifestyle influences your work as a photographer and vice versa.
That's interesting. I'm not sure. Nature photographers do travel by nature. That is their inherent thing. They have to be, A, they have to be nomadic. B, they have to be patient.
Anything, you know, words create images, and the image of a vagabond living out of your car, I want to intercede here and say that you're not a derelict, that you actually can't do a lot of camping, car camping. You're not
I've actually become somewhat addicted to tent living because of the air quality is so much better than in these buildings that we've created as a convention. Nowadays, when I walk out of this studio, I will just heave a sigh of relief as I hit the real air. It'll be a good moment to look forward to. But I have a fairly elegant camping gear. I had some fancy tents for a while, but they kept breaking, so I ended up with a $34 Walmart tent, and that serves me. And I just replace it when it's dies. And I have a lot of electronic gear in my car. I have pretty much of a power plant. I have two deep cycle marine batteries and a huge inverter, so I have 2,000 watts of AC power to power anything that I need to charge up. Or I had a desktop computer in there for a long time. I carried a 20-inch iMac, which is huge, but I finally sprung for the more sensible deal, a $2,000 portable unit that's good enough to do my photography work on, but doesn't require backbreaking maneuvers to set it up every day.
And it takes less space.
Yeah, a lot less space. Yeah, but I've just filled it up with other gadgets. I'm kind of a gadget geek.
So you're out on the road. I interrupted you, didn't I? You're out on the road.
And how does it inform my photography?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
you know, as opposed to like coming back to a base, you know, a lot of photographers travel, but they come back to a base from where they publish their work.
Yeah, no, what the bases I've come back to is the places where I can get close to the animals. I don't have the $10,000 for the long lenses. So my longest lens is about 340 millimeters. So it behooves me to get close to the animals. And the animals, it turns out, have certain places, we could call them zoos, where they allow people to get close to them. Often it has to do with a railing or something where they feel that there's a barrier. There was a situation in on the Anhinga Trail in the Everglades, which is a beautiful boardwalk with a lot of wildlife on it, and there's a bunch of alligators at the end of this walk, and a lot of bird life, and a woman dropped her lens cap off of the boardwalk onto the ground, right about 3 feet in front of this alligator, and she certainly wasn't going to get it. But finally she left, and the alligator left a little bit afterwards. So there were some other alligators down there, but they weren't too close, and I trust them anyway. They're pretty nice. They turn out to be decent citizens. They look creepy, but they're all right. Same with the grizzly bears. Anyway, I climbed over the thing, got the lens cap, and the minute I climbed over that railing, everything out there went nuts. All the birds started screaming, flying away. There was this big flurry. The gators were stirring around. And one of the humans had escaped its enclosure. And they were outraged and freaked. And I thought that was interesting. And so many places in the Everglades I can get within 3 feet of a great blue heron that I couldn't get within a mile of in Michigan. So I'm interested. And people tell me... rangers and so forth tell me that these animals, the same animal, will let you get close in one place and not in another. And it usually has to do with resources again. If there's a huge, rich body of resources, as there is in the Everglades, and there are people nearby, well, we'll put up with it this one tail.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm curious if you've spent an extended period of time photographing one individual animal.
Yeah, sure. Particularly with the bears, if there were bears, sort of the resident bears in these places. There were also bears that would come down for the salmon run from the mountains. They're quite different and quite beautiful. But there were local bears that just lived there all year long, so you'd see them most times. So you might see the same bear several times a day in these salmon run places. So a lot of my bear shots are Myra.
Neat. And so you're able to observe the individual characteristics of the animal as opposed to bear.
Very much so, yeah.
And you enjoy that?
Oh, hugely, yeah. That's a great part of it to me, is the behavior. It's a great interesting teacher for me to watch their animal and extrapolate to what we're up to. And there's always a connection, as I pointed out, with the resource thing, that that's what brings the hummingbirds in, that's what brings all these creatures in, and it was what makes us tick too. We run around for these resources.
Yeah, I'm curious, you just said something really interesting. Earlier in the interview, you mentioned that you meditate, and I'm curious, as your meditation practice has evolved, if your connection with the animals has evolved as well, because I know that, for example, if humans are very activated and anxious, the animals pick up on that and pretty much go away. So I'm curious how that's evolved for you as a nature photographer.
Well, I wish it would evolve more. I'm inherently a pretty twitchy and nervous person. There are people that have much better luck with the animals because of their sort of peaceful posture. It moves me in that direction, that I aspire to calm. You have to be pretty scared to...
You're calm enough for me, Pat.
Yeah, you have to be pretty scared to work this hard to be calm.
Would you be willing to talk at all about your other teachers? Or one or two of your other teachers, aside from the natural world?
Who are they? I'm not sure.
Don't get funny with me, Pat.
Well, this is too open-ended.
Okay.
I don't know where to go with that.
Well, should I name a name?
Sure.
I know that you've been very moved by the teachings of Pema Chodron.
Yeah, she's a sweetie. Yeah.
I'm almost unexposed, almost totally unexposed to her work.
Yeah.
But I know that she has touched, that she touches many, many people and instructs many people.
I think it's because she's from New Jersey. There's something about it that's authoritative in that accent that lingers with her. She's got a great sense of humor. She's a terrible meditator, thus a great teacher for those of us who think we're terrible meditators. And she's kind of hard-nosed in some way. She hung out with this guy, Trungpa, who was a piece of work. Apparently pretty fully realized guy. I talked to somebody who met him, and this guy was like me, kind of challenges everything. And he talked to Trungpa about, he kind of questioned him, you know, like, what, why are you sitting around meditating? What's the point of all this? And Trungpa, he said, went into his brain and tickled him. And Trungpa asked him, do you feel anything? And just because this guy was a jerk like me, he said, no. And then Trungpa tickled him so much that he just fell apart laughing. And he said, oh, okay. I feel something. And so this guy had some muscle, right? And Pema was his buddy. She was stuck close to him. She said she knew he was a dangerous man, and she wanted to know really what was going on here, so to find out that he wasn't going to hurt her. And she found out that he was totally trustworthy and that he cared nothing but to pass this knowledge on to his students. And I'll tell you, listening to Trungpa, to me, he seems like a total nutcase. I don't want anything to do with the guy. He's passed now, and he's a lunatic in my book, from what I heard. But she got something, and she's passing it on. And I'll tell you, I listened to her talk. That's what I do. I'm in the car, I'm driving down the road, and I listened to her, and I listened to What Now Show. Have you heard of that? What Now Show?
Yeah, I have.
It's a little place.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some little backwater.
Give me a break.
Backwater thing I listened to. It's better than NPR. And I will say, she is terrific. And I kind of vacillate back and forth between What Now and Pema. And it's just terrific stuff. You can listen to her books read by somebody else, and you'll say, yeah, okay, well, yeah. But you listen to her talk, and there's so much humor, there's so much life in there. Particularly recommend something called Bodhisattva Mind. It's a long piece, a lot of discussions, a lot of sessions, but she just came out of retreat. She'd been in retreat for something almost a year, I think, and she comes out, and she's just there. She's right there. And it's just gorgeous stuff. It's funny, it's fun, and it's just too challenging. It's hard work, what she asks you to do. Very hard work. Recently, I've had another teacher in that regard, which I tell people pretty explicitly that this is my work, and that the photography is kind of a cover story for how I'm going to explain. If the police stop me, I'm not going to tell them I'm trying to find myself. I'm going to say, yeah, I'm a photographer, I'm traveling. This book is Ken MacLeod's book, Wake Up to Your Life. What a fabulous thing. Oh, my God, it's dense. It's so difficult. It's so challenging. But if you're serious, if you want to get there, baby, read this thing. Just try it. I dare you.
Get where, Pat?
Wherever that is. I don't know. I'm sure not there. But, man, everything I test in what this guy says, totally right on. Resonates. It's like a grasp of psychology, of human activity, that just puts it in a place where you can kind of see how it's working. And when you test that and you say, well, is that really true, and try to follow it up, yeah, turns out it is. Yep. So wake up.
You said earlier, you're not, paraphrasing, you're not particularly crazy about people. wondering if some of us are becoming more agreeable as you get older and wiser, whether your understanding of the current human condition is softening or hardening. Or both together.
I read a wonderful book called "Songs of the Gorilla Nation," written by an autistic person. And when you read that book, it's a gorgeous book. But what she suggested was that her autism was not so much an indifference to humans, but an oversensitivity, that when people came close to her in various ways, she short-circuited. She couldn't function properly. They just basically blew her head apart. The interactions, human relationships, were just overtaxed her equipment, and so she had to protect herself. And in a way, that's the story. Isn't it? We think we're protecting ourselves. And Pema Chodron says, it's kind of sad. We put up a barrier because we're hurt. We don't want to get hurt. We want to protect ourselves. And then the barrier becomes a prison. And the only way out of it is to feel that very thing that we were trying to avoid. And Songs of the Gorilla Nations book, interestingly enough, she finds her way back to empathy and relationships by watching the gorillas in the zoo and watching them very closely, as only an autistic person can watch them. And eventually she watched them so well that they hired her to watch the gorillas, and she began to have relationships with these animals and they with her. And what she came to think was, she was suffering badly one day and she was weeping near one of the gorillas, and the gorilla came to try to comfort her. He reached through the little window to try to embrace her and comfort her, and she realized that that animal had no choice. Because of its development level, it was trapped, even though it had been tortured, imprisoned, degraded by humans, keeping it in a zoo. It couldn't help but embrace a member of its community that was suffering, but that we had the choice. And she made the choice to feel. Pretty powerful stuff. And I would say that my process has been something like that. Yeah, I would hope so. I seem to see a glimmer of compassion from time to time. And it's hard. It's hard because you see people living misguided lives. And if you love them and you're watching them go down, it's a difficult thing. It's kind of like the codependence nightmare. So, yeah, that stops the conversation, doesn't it? Maybe not. Sigh. Oh, there you know, we go. Beautiful sigh.
It doesn't stop the conversation so much as it just makes it ring.
Yeah. And it invites the empty space for beauty to emerge. I mean, the willingness to sit exactly where we're at is a rare form of courage in our culture these days.
Mm, and what a gift to everybody around it. Absolutely. Yeah.
I wish we had a little more time. Maybe we'll do another part two at some other day. But we are out of time. Pat, I want to thank you so very much for joining us and allowing our listenership to get to know you a little bit. You've been a gift to me, and not only personally, but your work is nourishment. And
thank you. My great pleasure.
Yeah.
Pathunt.net.
Pathunt.net. If you had waited 3 seconds, you would have heard those words springing from my lips.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay. Thanks, Pat, and thanks, Susie, for joining us. We'll be back in a few minutes with Kathleen Barry, and you're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California, and that's pathunt.net. And we've enjoyed having Pat here briefly in Sonoma County, and we hope to have him back again down the road. We'll be back in a few minutes.